How's your garden growing these days? Maybe the flower garden or the vegetable garden? Larry Mueller here, and in this edition of Garden Talk, we visit with Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Really pleased to have him along. Certainly, if you have some questions, and we can talk not only fruits and vegetables and flowers, but we could talk about trees as well. And I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Give a call. And Bob, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
It's raining down here in southern Wisconsin, so it's a good time to do a program like this because it can't be anywhere else.
can't be outside. I tell you what. Usually we begin picking raspberries around the first part of July, especially in central Wisconsin by then, but they're late.
Yes, and there's a couple of reasons for that. We had a very cool spring this year, and so a lot of things are a little bit later. We're figuring about 10 days later than average, and I had somebody from La Crosse send me an email the other day wondering why. And this would have been in early July. They hadn't started picking. And she said, in my records, we've always picked by the 30th of June.
Yeah.
And it's just the cooler temperatures. Things are a lot later. Everything is going to be later, including grapes and some of the apple varieties. Some of the late season apple varieties may have some challenges even ripening up this year, or at least coming up with a good quality fruit. So that cool, those cool temperatures we had all through May and early June really set things back.
Well, and just a word on strawberries. I don't think the strawberries overall were really very good this year.
Well, we had a few problems, and the heavy rains that we had, at least in the southern half, kind of messed things up a little bit. We had more disease problems. And then the other issue was that we had relatively cool temperatures followed by some very warm temperatures after about the 16th of June, and that speeded up the growing process. But all in all, there were good quality fruit out there. The fresh market growers were providing some very good product. But just mentally, you know, I mean, from year to year, you test only so many strawberries, but they probably weren't quite as sweet for some reason as other years. And it had to do probably with the growing season.
Yeah. Well, Kathy in Fox Cities has a question for you, so let's go to Kathy. Hi, Kath.
Hi. How are you, Larry and guest?
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having letting me speak. I am calling in regard to a hosta plant. We had some professional landscaping done 3 years ago. And after that, we ran into some potential water problems and it resulted in an electric generator being put on the house just to take away our concerns about the potential water. And the hosta closest to it suddenly has taken a dive, and it was one of our largest ones. And for the 3 years it's been here, it has bloomed, it has done what it's supposed to do and looked wonderful. And this year it turned white and the leaves got almost a mushy consistency.
Huh.
And my husband is thinking that the air or warm air that's given off from the generator when it runs weekly for 15 minutes as a test might have an effect on it. Any comments?
Your husband's pretty close to right. There's a couple of things going on there. Especially with with a gas type engine, you're giving off hydrocarbons, and certain hydrocarbons can even be a growth regulator impact. For example, on pineapple, during World War II, they had a spill of jet fuel, and they found the whole pineapple field bloomed and everything at one time, and so it had to do with the hydrocarbons, and that led to some of the ripening agents or stimulating plants to flower at a certain time. I'm only guessing, but I'm suspecting you've got a couple things. One is heat from the generator has some impact on it, and the other thing is some of the hydrocarbons. Your only options would be to either put some type of barrier in between to kind of prevent that exhaust from hitting the plant materials. That's one thing you could possibly do, or just simply change your landscape a little bit.
Yeah, move the plant. That's about it.
Well, at this point, remove the plant and not have anything. May I ask a question about knockout roses?
Sure.
Thank you. I have in the front of the house, which faces east, I have three that have just done beautifully. They have grown each year, and there's just a proliferation of growth on them that is jaw-dropping. The three behind the house, we've had to change twice now because they simply don't survive the winter. Granted, we had a difficult winter last year, but I wanted to try once more. We checked the soil. Everything seems all right. So and the ones in back are west-facing. So it just befuddles me why they wouldn't make it in the back, and they do so well in the front.
Well, Dr. Laura Jell would be the person to really talk about knockout roses because she's done a lot of research on those. And I was involved with our hardiness trials all the way up to Spooner and Ashland area that we did probably about 6 years ago. But anyway, just getting back to the knockout rose is hardy, somewhat hardy for Wisconsin. It's a marginal thing. I see that some of the plants, when we have harsher winters, like last winter, it was hard on a lot of plant materials, that some of those things just don't do as well. And even small little microclimates that happen around your house can have an impact. For example, on the west side of your house, you might have more prevailing winds, which would be somewhat detrimental. Also, watch the soil conditions. Is it a little bit wetter there? It sounds like you're in a wetter zone, and that would then... because there may be a little more standing water, you might have more root rots, which will kind of place the plant in decline. One suggestion for if you have a wet zone is to plant the plant on a little bit of a mound. It only has to be probably 4 or 6 inches, but when you landscape, make kind of a mound, set the plants on top of the mound, and that allows the roots to dry a little bit, and you may have fewer disease problems. So it could be an environmental issue that's causing that.
Good luck. Thank you.
And can you put something around them maybe in back, like burlap to cover those, because it has been built up by the landscapers?
That burlap does provide some protection. We use that more on evergreens than anything else to cut down on wind damage to the leaf tissue, and that's primarily during the winter months. Roses lose most of their leaves, so I'm guessing you have more of a challenge with the soil than maybe anything else that's going on there.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Kathy. Want to give some others a chance to get in here, so let's go to Laura in Arpen next. Hi, Laura.
Hello. I grew potatoes for the first time this year. And I was really surprised that the potato bugs were on them when the plants were just inches tall. So I was wondering about where the potato bugs come from. And then I've just been hand-picking them off to try and control them. But what do I do to prevent the problem next year?
Well, you're going to have to – there's a very good extension bulletin on potato beetles. But where do they come from? What they do is potato beetles live on other weed plant materials like black nightshade and a lot of other things, and we never really pay attention to them in those locations. It could be along a fence row, it could be a hedgerow. There's a lot of areas that they can live, and they tend to migrate in from those locations. A few things that you can do with the potato beetles. Some people, like in a garden situation, well, first of all, try to plant the potatoes fairly early. I'm guessing that when they arrived, you might have planted your potatoes maybe a little bit later in May, but potatoes you can plant as soon as the ground thaws out and dries out. But some people will plant eggplant on the margins of their gardens. When those insects come to the garden, they're attracted due to some of the chemicals that are given off by those plants, and they'll show up there, and that's a pretty good indicator plant. So people start watching. When they see them show up there, they'll pick off the adults. When they're feeding there. So those are used as trap plants. There are some pest management programs that you can look at. There's a couple of organic type insecticides. There's a BT product out there, Bacillus thuringiensis, that you could consider trying. Some of the original insecticides that we're using, we find that some of the potato beetles have developed a resistance to those. So we're looking at some of these other types of products.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. Jeff in Wausau. On to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. You bet.
My question was about bell peppers. My wife and I have planted a little patio garden out on our patio, and one of the bell pepper plants has over 30 blossoms on it, and I'm wondering if that's too many for that plant.
Well, the plant will abort flowers as is needed. And with peppers, they're probably, when we look at peppers, they're one of the more sensitive types of warm season crops that you can grow. The abortions will come about is if the root system tends to dry out, and in your container garden or patio type system, you have to be very cautious to that. Nightly temperatures, when they drop below 50 degrees, will cause some abortion. So the plant will kind of wall off and select a certain number of fruit to develop usually, and so I really wouldn't worry about that.
Okay, well then I'll just keep going as we're doing, and we'll let the plant do its work.
You right. Betcha. Yep.
Thank
all right,
you
thanks. Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
And what I was trying to suggest is watering is very important with peppers.
Yeah.
And temperature control, well, sometimes we can't do it, anything about it, but if we do have a small planting, you can always cover those if the temperatures are going to drop below. And that's night temperatures,
right.
Below 50 degrees.
On to Norm in Wausau. Norman, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Two questions. One is, what is the best thing to use on spider mites on an apple tree? I've got a couple of them that are starting to get spider mites. We're a little drier up here. I have an option of Acromite, Omite, or Piola of the ones that I know about. And then the second question is on what's causing the death of a lot of my raspberry canes. It seems something over the winter did it.
Okay. On the spider mites, it's dry, and that's when the populations increase. And usually when you have a good heavy rainfall, it tends to knock a lot of the spider mites off of the plant. When you start using, when we try controlling spider mites, it's more difficult to do that because we're also knocking out a lot of beneficial insects that are feeding on them. And so you really mess up the ecology. Just a couple of things you might want to do is there's a very good extension bulletin on insect management on apples. Take a look, and I didn't catch if you were a homeowner or whatever, so the products available to you are going to be somewhat limited if you're a homeowner. But I'm guessing with the spider mites, if you only have one tree, take the garden hose out and just spray the heck out of it a couple times a week, and that'll knock down the population. And usually the spider mites. Now, if you have some other mites that are feeding and leaving the russeting on the apple, those are mites that have overwintered, and then there's some miticides that you would use, but you use that as a dormant oil or early spring application. You knock down the population then. After that, it's rather difficult, and usually we'll see russeting or just scaly roughness near the stem or near the petiole end of the fruit. As for your raspberries, the question I have is, did they green up and then they died before the ripening?
Right.
Okay.
They look pretty good. And then they died. Now that occurs both on the raspberries and some very hardy blackberries as well.
Yep.
In other words, they even bloomed.
Yep.
And then
yep.
They just kind of died down.
They collapse about 2 weeks before you pick.
Yep.
And that's usually a cane blight, and that's a fungal disease that gets started on the plant the season before because you're dealing with a biennial plant. And a few things that you can do is, one, thin the cane so you only have about 4 canes per linear foot a row, so you allow good air movement through there. Whenever you do any pruning, come in with some type of fungicide or copper fungicide material. And you want to do that within 3 hours of any pruning activity because those new wounds, even when you cut a plant off, pull it out, those little bristles are rubbing against the primal canes that you save. And that causes some infection sites. So that spray program. Also, take a look, watch when you're doing your pruning and when you're saving your primal canes, you'll see kind of a purpling down at the base, usually next to where a leaf is attached. And that
right.
means that the disease got started there. And it starts plugging up the vascular tissue, and it completely plugs it that 2 weeks before fruit harvest.
No.
And that's why they die.
Okay.
So try to prune those out when you're doing your pruning.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Norm, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture and UW-Madison and UW-Extension, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation on Garden Talk with Bob Tomesch, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's turn to Pat in East Troy next. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and Bob. Thanks for letting me on.
Sure.
About oh, at least 3 months ago, I had a rutabaga that sprouted before I got to use it. And when I was ready to use it, I cut off the sprouts with some flesh and put them in water. And 2 months later, they had continued to have green leaves, and I planted them outside. Now they're outside, and what used to be little sprouts are over a foot and a half tall, and I don't know what to do. How can I make this pay off for me and grow myself some real rutabagas that I can eat?
Okay. Normally, rutabagas are started from seed. And what you've done is you save a rutabaga part that you planted, and I'm guessing that it's going to move into a flowering phase because the rutabagas are actually a biennial plant. The first year's vegetative produces the root, and we normally eat the root. When you overwinter them and replant them out, or in your case, you cut off the top and it develops some adventitious roots, what's there is most likely going to send up a flower stalk, and it's going to look... probably either white or yellow flowers will develop on that.
I have one, and it's yellow.
Okay. Guessed right on that one. But what's happened is you're not gonna, that is not going to develop a root because that phase of the plant's life, the second year, is all going to be focused on seed production. Now, if you want to try something, you can let that develop its pods. It's going to be like a radish that you left in the garden too long. It's going to have small pods on it. When they begin to dry, you can try saving some of the seeds. Because there aren't too many rutabagas growing or grown in the area, they will probably self-pollinate and probably be fairly close to the original plant that you grew.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'll try the try for next year.
All right, good. Thanks a lot for calling, Pat. And Kathy in Appleton, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Say, Bob, I have a flowering pink almond plant that bloomed in the spring, and I was all excited because it was the first year that I had it. And it never leafed, not one leaf after that. It's just brown sticks. Is it dead?
It's dead.
Oh.
It's dead.
How can a dead plant bloom?
What happened is with several plants that bloom, and almonds bloom very early in the spring, probably earlier than anything else. And they're just, one, not really hardy enough for this part of our for Wisconsin, although we've got some trial plants in a couple of places. Those buds grew out, but I'm guessing that either the leaf buds were damaged, or many times the cambium or the zone in between the bark and the wood is damaged. Usually then you get the plant to leaf out and then die about the first week of June. But it sounds like in your case it was just cold winter injury.
All right.
Oh, interesting, because I have another one further north that's doing beautifully.
Yeah,
little microclimates.
Okay, my second question was about my clematis. I have two. Both of them flowered beautifully and were tall and green, and now one of them has completely turned brown as though it had already had a winter frost.
It sounds like you may have some damage down near the base of the plant. Earwigs. Are heavy feeders on clematis. That's one of their choice plants. Usually they eat the flowers off and leave the rest, but I'm guessing take a look right at the base, and if they've browned up, cut those back and see if they'll reshoot from the root system. They'll still get enough energy to overwinter the what's left of the plant.
Should I cut them back to 6 inches from the ground like I would in the fall?
Yep.
No kidding.
And it's possible that if it's so wet that you might have had some root rot damage also. It depends on what part of Wisconsin you're in.
Well, again, Appleton. But it's interesting to have one 20 feet away that's in perfect health.
Well,
drainage varies short distance.
A lot.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. You know, I've got some flowers and bushes along the lakeshore, and on one side of the little sidewalk area there, They're great, and on the other side, they're stunted or smaller, and, you know, you dig down in there, and there's a lot more rock and stuff on the one side, and we're talking 4 foot apart.
Well, a lot of things is when we have excavations done, like in our yard, the soil they put back in, if it's a poor quality, I mean, it's so mixed, and we have a lot of several complaints or calls that come in with landscapes that were done on, especially newer homes that were built in the last 10 years where they resculpture the whole area. You can't even believe it was a cornfield before that. But the soil below the topsoil, they only put on a couple, 3 inches of topsoil, probably came from 20 feet down. So it lacks in nutrients and everything else.
Yeah.
And the plant starved. There's no way of retaining the water. So we're trying to encourage landscapers to just be aware of when they're starting to plant, to have a good soil area down below the plant as well.
Let's turn to Jeremy in Milwaukee next. Jeremy, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great.
Two questions. The first is if you can give me any advice on my never-ending war against what I understand to be field bindweed in my perennial garden.
Okay.
It just comes right up through the mulch where the plants I want are, and it just winds its way around the plants, drags them down.
Yep.
And all I've been able to do is every couple days get into the garden, find them, and rip them out. But they seem to grow faster than I can rip them out.
Yep. Well, the reason they're regrowing is that even though the plant is producing seeds as it grows, and so those seeds at the bottom are releasing seeds and they're re-coming up. You have a couple of options that you could try doing, and one would be using a herbicide like Dacthal or Preen that you can purchase, and placing that down. What that will do is interrupt the seed production. Otherwise, you're doing what else can be done, and that's weed, weed, weed.
Yeah.
Right. Now, does the Preen, what's that going to do to the plants I like?
Well, take a look at the label, and usually what Preen does is it impacts seed germination. And so you're growing transplants. A lot of people will use Preen like on perennial flower beds and things like that because those are perennial roots. They're deeper. And what happens with the Preen products, if applied at the recommended rates, it will impact seed germination. So those weed seeds that you have there start germinating, but they never develop a root system, so they starve to death for lack of water and lack of nutrients.
Oh, great. I'll look into it. Second question, my black-eyed Susies, lot of brown spots on the leaves. The flower, I mean, everything's a little behind schedule, but the flowers, I think, appear to be approaching bloom in the normal fashion, but I'm wondering if I have to worry about the brown spots on the leaves.
Well, this year we have a lot of brown spots, and Brian Huddleston would be the one to probably give you the litany or list of diseases because we had a lot of anthracnose. There's a lot of other types of diseases that will impact those plants. It's on the leaf tissue. Hopefully it won't, and it's far enough along that any fungicides that you apply to the leaf tissue really isn't going to slow it down anymore. So you're going to have to kind of live with it. And the weather conditions that we had this year, it's real wet, then it's humid, and all those things are conducive for fungal diseases. On the flower, it should still produce the flowers that you want. It's a foliar disease. Next fall, when you get ready to clean up the garden, make sure that you get any of that disease tissue out of the garden. Get it either composted or buried about 3 feet, 2 feet down. We'd like to bury it deeper than that. But anyway, get rid of that and then use mulch around the plants. A lot of those disease organisms, they drop from the leaf tissue into the soil, and they will reinfect the following year. And some people put down fresh mulch between their plants, and that'll kind of help keep them in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Jeremy, for calling. And on to Donna in West Salem. Hi, Donna.
Hi. My question is, at what growth stage of the zucchini plant does that worm show up, and what do you do to prevent it?
You're talking about the worm in the vine?
Yes.
Well, sorry to tell you, but the adults have been here at least 2 weeks laying eggs. and your population does build up, and one of the things that usually around the 1st of July is when the adults are there laying eggs, and then when the larvae hatch, they will burrow into the vine, and usually you begin seeing some wilt in late afternoon for probably 3-4 days, and then it finishes it off where it just simply eats enough of the vine tissue. If you see the wilt factor, you can start cutting back from the tip of the vine back, and you might find the worm in there. And you can physically remove that grub, and hopefully you'll have some shoots coming out in the axils that will eventually bring you back production. Now, it doesn't impact every plant, but the ones that are wilting are the ones that have the larvae in there from the squash vine borer.
All right.
Okay.
Good
Thank
luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. And Beverly in Marshfield. Your turn now. Hi, Bev.
Hi. You have knowledge I admire so much, I can't believe. Okay, well, I had chives that had always been, you know, scattered throughout my yard. And this year, almost all of them died out except a patch in the very backyard. And I'm wondering when I should transplant to get new plants going, or should I depend on the purple flowers that are in full force now, and then dry them, and then plant those seeds, or can I plant the whole plant right now?
The one that survived probably was a little more hardy. That's one thing. Also, that we had very wet conditions, but even though chives are probably one of the hardier types of plants that we do have, they do succumb to some root rots, especially during wet conditions.
Uh-oh.
I would take the plant that you have. You can divide that. If you divide it now, the clump, you can break it down into like one inch segments and spread those out. But cut the leaf tissue down to maybe 2 inches, and it'll send up some new leaf tissue. But you could divide them now, or it would be better to wait till the end of August versus September. That's a better time. Right now, what happens when we do some transplanting, we get a week of hot weather, the plant just can't get enough water because we've kind of impacted the root system. So you've got a couple of choices. Also, when you set out your chives in the new bed, use a little bit of raised bed concept there, especially in a flower bed. I often suggest to people that if they raise the flower bed about 2 inches and then place their mulch on it, it allows for a drain-off area from any excess water, and so that soil will be a little bit drier.
Okay, now let me get this straight. Now, you said that it might be better for me to wait until the end to the end of August to start splitting them. And,
yep, that would be a little bit better. You could do it now. I would, you know, if you really are a really good gardener and you go out and talk to your plants every morning so you can give them a little bit of water.
Yeah.
I
tell them how cute they are.
There you go. You could do it now.
Okay.
And maybe only take half of the hill.
Because
what you're doing is you're in a learning situation. But take about half the hill, divide it up, and like I said, cut off the almost all the tops and replant them, and then water them every day.
Now, would you advise a really hot, sunny place or semi-sun? Because they used to grow in semi-sun.
Yep. They'll grow either way.
Okay.
And it's hot, sunny. Right now in July and August, we have some very hot weather and hot suns.
That's going to be coming.
It draws a lot of the plant releases a lot of water, and so it can't absorb enough, and that's usually what the stress factor is.
Well, then what about those purple flowers that are going great now? Should I pick those and dry them and then plant them anew? Come springtime?
I would let them dry down before you pick those. And there are seeds in there, and they will reseed.
And they will reseed?
Sometimes
they do.
Oh, sometimes.
Well, I say sometimes because the seed has to be ripe enough in order to go through the germination process. And if you pick the purple ones now, the seed probably isn't mature enough.
Okay. And, wait until they look really, really dry.
You got it.
And then gather them.
Yep.
Good luck. Thank you, Bev, for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Argyle, we turn to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of questions about raspberries. One, I've grown some in the past, and I'd never noticed this kind of a pest before. I was out in the patch the other day, and where I had pruned the berries last fall, there at the end of the stalk, there was like a pile of sawdust there, and I watched for a little while, and there was some little guy carrying stuff out and dumping it out. And I don't know what kind of a pest that would be. Spur of the moment, I grabbed a piece of grass stem and tried to push it down in there and smash the guy, and then I put a piece of oak in the end of that hole. But I was just curious what that might be.
Okay. Is this near the top of the cane or to the bottom?
At the top of the cane where it was pruned off.
Okay.
It was going right in the center pithy part of the stalk.
Yeah. I can't venture a guess on that one. What if you could do is get a digital picture and email it to either me or Phil Pelletieri, Yeah, we'll try to. If you get it to me, I get it to Phil.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all.
I didn't get a very good sighting of him. I just kind of saw the back end of him. I know there are some little black beetles with like gold markings on them that really love to eat the raspberries.
That's something. Those are
totally different.
Those are picnic beetles. What you might want to do is if you see them burrowing, go to work and cut off that segment and slowly split open the cane so you can see either the insect or the worm. And
okay. We'll
go from there. Or if you want to throw the insect in a little vial and send it to us.
Okay.
Send it on Monday so it doesn't dry out.
Okay. The other question, or could I put it in alcohol somehow and send it?
Yeah. We can't tell you to do that because you're not allowed to ship alcohol in the mail right now. It's a flammable item.
Okay. The other question, I tried a couple of times with raspberries. Unsuccessfully to grow from cuttings, but I was taking a woody cutting. Do I want to take just the green part of the stem, like just behind the leaf?
Raspberries are a bit of a challenge to propagate asexually the way you're from cuttings. If you want to increase your planting, when those new shoots come up in the spring, they're about 4 inches tall.
Uh-huh.
Dig out a segment, but make sure you dig down deep enough. You'll see the stem go down, and at about 4 inches down or 6 inches, there'll be a horizontal-like root or rhizome structure. You want about 3-4 inches on either side of the stem that goes down to transplant with that, and that's one way of multiplying your plants out very easily.
Okay, the one I had found in the past, it worked pretty good to run a tiller beside the, just till it up beside the raspberries, and they just come up like wildfire.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'll tell you how many of those little shoots there are. One time we dug some of those horizontal stems up, and
yeah.
We looked at them under a microscope, and we were counting between 50 and 100 little buds per inch. So that's why you start out with a raspberry planting and end up with a raspberry patch.
And I did have a lot of good success with elderberry, taking cuttings from the elderberry plant and dipping those in the rooting.
Yep.
And want to grow those for the birds and for us too, I think.
Some plants propagate much easier. There's some very good propagation books to kind of do some reading, and some will say softwood, hardwood, root cuttings, whatever. But it'll give you a little background. You can usually go to your local library and find some information on that.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jerry. Joan and Iola, you're up next. Hi, Joan.
I have two questions. First, a quick one. You mentioned planting eggplant if you're planting potatoes.
Yes.
You mentioned that earlier in the program.
Yes.
What does the eggplant do?
Well, when it comes to the potato beetle comes to the table to eat, he will eat eggplant before he moves to the potatoes. And so those are called trap or indicator plants. Then you know they've showed up.
Okay, well, I didn't plant potatoes, but I did plant 3 eggplants this year.
Yeah.
Now my other real question. I have a plum tree in the backyard and apple trees also. Last year in July when we had the horrendous hail in central Wisconsin and it killed all of my garden and it just knocked all the fruit off our tree. The plum tree has, I think it's like a bluish-gray lichen all up and down on the trunk, but not up the tree, just on the main trunk. And we have this new Honeycrisp apple tree, and it's got the same thing now this year.
What do you think that is?
Well, first of all, if you got lichens on your tree, that means you've got a healthy environment.
Yeah.
They're not hurting the tree at all. They're just a secondary. They're living on the older bark that's dead and sloughing off. You find lichens on rocks and trees and things of that nature. So nothing to worry about.
You have to cut them off.
No, you don't have to cut them off. Leave them be, Joan. And thanks a lot for calling. Jim in West Salem, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have a flower bed next to the driveway in the corner. And in the wintertime, of course, it's piled high with snow from the sidewalk and from the street. I was wondering, and what I have in there now, basically, I have some resurrection lilies that will be coming up. I would like to have some daylilies put in there, the yellow ones that look very attractive. Am I smart in doing that, or am I going to have a problem with it because of the snow in the wintertime, or should I just plant annuals in there instead of perennials?
Well, you can always try the lilies. There's a couple of types. There's the daylily type, the Stella d'Or, and that one produces flowers over a long period of time, and people often grow that. Those are pretty tough, and those are pretty good plants for that. Some of the bulb type of lily that just has one shoots up and then has the yellow flowers up at the top, those are take a lot of care, especially in a situation like you have there. So I'd go with the Stella d'Or or something like that. And try it. If they don't make it, and you're talking about salts and compaction and everything else, you can always then go over and back. If you don't succeed, come back with annuals.
Okay, but what was the daylily again?
Stella d'Or.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lorene and Toma, on to you now. Hi, Lorene.
Hello. Last year, I tried planting Kentucky Blue Wonder beans, and I'm still wondering where the beans were. I had like 30 vines and no beans. I had like 10 beans, and I had good pollination as far as I could tell, lots of blossoms, but the bean production was way down. This year, I'm planted bush beans, bush green beans, and they came up so viciously, I was like, wow, I'm really going to have beans this year. And now the leaves have turned, in certain spots on the leaves, they turned kind of whitish, and then they turned yellow-brown. Not the whole leaf, just those sections.
Yeah.
And I want some beans. They can't be that difficult to grow, can they?
Well, no. You've probably got, the vines are too thick. And it sounds like you've either got one of the fungal diseases, I'll just leave it at that, that are getting started because of your thick vines, and you just got them way overcrowded. Usually we have the anthracnose and some of those things come in, powdery mildews, as the vines get a little bit older. And that really doesn't impact the fruit production, but it gives you poor quality fruit. So my only suggestion I would have is try to thin out the plants with your pole beans. You want to have one about every foot. And even with the bush beans, I think they suggest 4 to 6 inches between plants.
Yeah, I think that's what my son planted them as. Yeah. But if they're 4 inches, I'll increase them to at least 6.
Yep. And the other thing is they definitely need full sun. If you got a shade of a tree that kind of overpowers them either in the morning or the afternoon, you're just setting up a better situation for diseases. Also, they need full sun in order to stimulate flower bud production.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Lorene, for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer and UW Extension, UW-Madison horticulturist, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we normally talk about fruits and so forth on Fridays on Garden Talk programs, but I wanted to let you know that on Thursday, July 24th, we'll be talking about cherries, and we'll be in Door County to do it. I'll be broadcasting live from the Peninsula Players Theater in Door County on the 24th, so you are invited to come. The Peninsula Players Theater is a beautiful new theater. And it's worth coming just to see the theater. But I'll be with Dean Vollenberg, who is a Door County Ag agent, and we'll talk about cherries and the cherry business with him a little bit and answer your questions. I think we're also going to be taking a look at exploring Door County, taking a look a little bit at the culture, the history, the natural beauty with Paul Burton, who's an author and publisher and has written a lot about Door County. So that's on the 24th at, of course, the 11 o'clock show. And then I wanted to mention, too, that if you're in the Oshkosh, Appleton, or Green Bay areas and you want to ride up, we're hosting a Wisconsin Public Radio shuttle bus. So we'll pick you up and take you right to the broadcast. And it's going to be a lot of fun. Come a little early, ask some questions. We'll be there to, talk a little bit informally before the show. And then after the show, I don't know about you, but I'm heading out for a fish boil. You're invited to that, too. We'll have a little fish boil afterwards, and it's really going to be a lot of fun. If you'd like to get some tickets or get involved in this, there's not a cost associated with it, but the number to call is 920-465-2502. That's 920-465-2502. And I also think you can find out some more at wpr.org/DoorCounty. And we've got some information for you on the website as well. So it's our normal website, and then put a slash mark and Door County on it. And looking forward to it, July 24th. That's a Thursday. And again, for tickets, 920-465-2502. And we've got some other problems to deal with here, Bob. So let's go let's go back to the phones. And Carolyn in Wautoma is up next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Don't know if you can really help me, but I'm kind of desperate here. I have a nectarine tree that I started from seed from a nectarine that I had bought in the store.
Yep.
Didn't think it could be done, but the tree is probably about 10 years old. We moved from Waukesha to Wautoma 4.5 years ago. When we moved, we moved in October, and that following spring, I got blossoms, which I had never had before. I had two nectarines, the juiciest. They were small, but they were the juiciest, sweetest things I've ever had. Since then, I haven't had nor flower nor fruit. I did move it to a better soil, a raised bed, not real high, but a raised bed to try to keep it away from the deer. I cover it with Remay for the winter to try to keep it from the wind and stuff, and I don't know what else to do. Can you help?
Well, you're doing more than most people would do.
Yeah.
Nectarines are almost a zone 6 plant, and so even surviving winter is a surprise, but we hear of that from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the little extra care that you're giving, everything from wrapping it and everything else is providing that little extra assistance. Part of the thing that it leafs out, if we look at flower buds and leaf buds, usually the flower buds are about 10 degrees more tender than the leaf buds. And so, in mm-hmm. other words, if the plant can tolerate 15 below, which is, I think nectarines are closer to zero or like 10 below, but if it gets a little bit colder than that, like 5 below, it'll knock out the flower buds already, but the leaf buds will survive, and that's probably what's happening. The stars and the moon and everything were probably in a line just right that winter, and that's why you had a few flower buds, and that's why you had the fruit. Once you've tasted that homegrown either peaches or nectarines...
Hard to go back,
boy,
isn't it?
Boy, I'll tell you, you'll really work hard to try to have that happen. I had a peach tree one year. We had peaches on it, and they were the most flavorful and delicious, but you think I can get it to happen again?
No.
Is it true that the fruit buds, do they start up and form in the fall?
They actually start now in June.
Oh, they do.
And then they're inside of a bud in the fall. It overwinters inside the bud, and then the spring it just does nothing more than open. If you were to actually take a microscope, make a section through it, you could even pick out the petals and everything else in that bud.
Is it possible, now with just covering with Remake, could I maybe up the ante with covering it with burlap, then plastic, then the Remake, so that I wouldn't make it too hot in there a little bit of an opening at the top for heat to escape?
Yeah.
Would that
be? Here's one little secret that I know somebody that in northern Wisconsin does, is they actually take the plant, they have it in a container, and for the winter it gets brought into a garage, and they keep it watered. And where it's not as cold, it probably only gets down to maybe 10 above. And then in the spring, they wheel it back out, and they do get fruit off of it.
Oh. Oh. Well, that would keep the deer off of it, too, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
that's right.
I wouldn't have to keep hanging my bars of Irish Spring all over it, which does help. Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn, for calling. Appreciate it. One way to do it. On to Deneen and Lodi next. Hi, Deneen.
Hello, Larry. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a beautiful delphinium in my garden, and it has been growing like 5.5 to 6 feet tall. It has gorgeous plumes, baby blue, and very robust. And it's the only one I've ever been able to grow. I've tried to grow maybe 3 or 4, and they all die. So this is really special. But this spring, it started to grow, and the stalks came out, and they kind of went sideways, and it drooped a little bit like a candelabra, and then the stalks kind of started to go up a little bit, and we looked in the middle of it, and my husband thought that a mouse might have dug around in there. So it's all kind of brown in the middle, but it is still blossoming very beautifully. But I'm worried about next year, and I'm wondering, you know, if we should cut off those stalks now or later, or, you know, what can I do to...
Only some of the stalks are drooping?
No, they all are.
Okay.
And they're not drooping. I mean, they're alive and they're robust, but they just have this odd shape.
Yeah.
Because they go over and then, you know, then it's like they're kind of lying on the ground, and
then
the
flower shoots straight up.
Yeah.
It could be there's a lot of things. Delphiniums tend to develop root rots.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you're coming along, so that's not an issue. Usually with root rots, they die out. That's why delphiniums have to be replanted every once in a while, and using that raised bed concept will help a little bit. I'm just guessing that you might want to, sometimes they suggest using a trellising device to help hold the shoots upright. I would just simply let it go through its phase this year, and then next year try to trellis the plants. If it's any disease organism, the plant won't be there next year. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. But I would just simply let it, because when it's flowering, the leaf tissue there is feeding that rhizome system. When you end up at the end of the flowering stage, cut off the flower stalks, leave just the leaves there so that it really feeds that root system. There's a few things that could have happened. Sometimes you over-fertilize, and that'll cause so much growth, and then the stems aren't strong enough to hold it, and they will collapse. Sometimes there's an insect that might be working on it, or the weather conditions. You get a lot of rain, and there's just so much rapid growth, and then it can't hold itself up.
Well, maybe that's what happened.
Could be.
I think we kind of noticed that after one of the really early heavy rains.
Yeah,
could be.
Okay, but then we saw the brown, and we're kind of worried that, you know, a mouse had gotten in there. Now, we do put four stakes in the ground, actually tall wires, and then string around it. I'm wondering, do we need to put them closer to the plant? Is that what you mean by...
Well, what I'm saying is you need to do the trellising when the plant is maybe only a foot or two tall, and just kind of increase the trellis to kind of help hold it up.
Okay.
What happens is you've got so much vegetative growth on it that... It just can't hold it up. I've got one of these fast-growing popples, and the last 3 weeks, it's probably a 2-inch trunk. It's laying on the ground.
Oh.
Because it's growing so fast, it can't hold it up. I've seen in Arizona, there's these trees, you know, it's a dry area. And I was talking to this one gardener, and I said, how come that's laid down? And he says, well, these plants grow in areas where we normally don't water, and this person's putting on so much water, it's growing so fast, it can't hold itself up. So he was pulling it back in place. So, yeah, just things that we have had a lot of rain. They said 3 inches here last night, and I don't know what we got since daybreak. But little episodes like that, and although we had 2 weeks of really dry and people kept saying it's too wet out there, we needed to be watering our gardens. Even the lawns were starting to brown up. So, water management is very important, but when Mother Nature overdoes it, then we got to kind of come up with some other strategies.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it, Deneen. Shannon in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I planted a green spire linden 2 summers ago, and after I planted it, I went to the Extension publications and learned about the linden borer, and I've been looking for one now for 3 summers and haven't found one, but I did discover 3 weeks ago a area on the trunk of the tree that doesn't look good. About 6 inches up from the earth, there is a strip of the bark that is cracked, and it seems to be growing in its length, and also when you put your thumb on that part of the bark, it's soft and leaves an indentation, and that seems to be increasing. And so the publication suggested treating the tree in late May with permethrin, which I didn't do because I discovered this the end of June, and I still haven't seen a vor. I did treat it with imidacloprid, thinking maybe systemically there might be something that could be done.
Yeah.
But my question is, since I don't see an insect, I don't have anything to mail to a lab, and I don't think you would cut bark out, would you have an arborist look at it, or what would you recommend that one does? It's a pretty good-sized tree. It's
yep.
about a 3 or 4 inch diameter and about 10 feet tall.
Yep. I don't think you have the borer, and if you're using the systemic insecticide, that just gives you some extra protection. What probably has happened, and I think the linden borer is overemphasized as a pest problem, because it usually will hit trees that are stressed. Boulevard trees are stressed, and lindens aren't made for boulevards. Sometimes in very dry, sandy soils. When we have a stressed tree, we tend to have more insect problems. So that's probably not the issue. The damage, the crack that you're seeing, is it on the west side or southwest side? Then it could be some winter injury that had occurred, and the softness has to do with the fact that the tree is self-healing.
All right.
Oh.
Information, good information there. Thanks very much for calling, Shannon. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Bob Tomasch, Senior Lecturer in UW Extension and UW-Madison Horticulturist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bob Tomasch, Senior Lecturer in the UW Department of Horticulture and UW Extension. Really glad to have him along today. You can join in with a question at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Annika is on next from Washington Island, Bob, so let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a question about tomatoes. We have a small greenhouse, and we grow the tomatoes in tubs. They do very well, but they're already at the top of the cages, and eventually they grow way overhead. I've wondered if I couldn't cut that center stem or pitch them in some way. Would they produce more fruit on the lower limbs, or would I be losing out entirely on more tomatoes?
Well, a couple of things you might want to do when you grow them in the greenhouse. There are certain varieties that are indeterminate, and that sounds like what you have. They just continue to grow upward and produce fruit. There are some varieties that you could try for greenhouse that are developed that are more determinate type. In other words, they only grow about so tall. And you might want to select some of the, like the old patio tomato is a perfect example of one that is shorter. And the commercial growers are looking at like Mountain Spring and some of those varieties as being, or Jet Star is indeterminate. But you have some options there. But what you're talking about is cutting them back. What will happen is they will tend to sucker at the leaf, in the axil of the leaf will send up a new shoot. And you can try managing and keeping them down that way. What often happens is you get so much vegetative growth because not only one bud stem grows, but you probably have about four or five, and then you get such a thick clump of plant material. But you could culture those that way.
Sure.
Oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
I do cut out a lot of the leaf growth pretty early on and continue to do that. Is that the correct thing to do?
Well, cutting out leaf growth, usually we do that on the lower part of the plant to cut down on infection sites. In other words, the first 6 to 12 inches from the ground, or in your case, from the pots or whatever that you have there. A couple of other things. I'm just trying to toss out some suggestions for you. One would be to stagger your plantings. In other words, starting from seed so that you always have 3-4 plants that are very small and producing when they get up to the height that you don't want to deal with them anymore.
Dump them out.
They're done. The other thing is some people will actually develop a trellis that goes up and then horizontally at about 6 or 7 feet, and it's almost like picking grapes off, and that's how the fruit will harvest. So you've got some options in terms of the management of what you're doing. I see Washington Island, a lot cooler, and that's where you're growing them in a greenhouse. I had a friend that grew up in Norway, and he said that's the only way they had tomatoes and cucumbers and some warm season crops is because they had a greenhouse attached to their house. Otherwise, it was always too cool to grow that stuff.
Ah, interesting. Thanks a lot for calling, Annika. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I went in Disney in Orlando.
Epcot. Yeah.
And at Epcot, and they went through their area there where they grow the plants indoors, and they had a cherry tree or a cherry tomato tree in there that's produced thousands and thousands and thousands of cherry tomatoes.
Oh, yes. Some of those indeterminate types will just keep right on growing. I can remember when I first started teaching at the university, I had a student from French Guiana, and we're talking about growing peppers. And, of course, here, that's an annual, right?
Right.
She says, well, we grow them for usually 3 or 4 years, but then they start producing. And they have such a woody trunk on, we have to take an axe to cut them off. Oh, that's interesting. They grow like a small tree. They're about 6 feet tall.
A little different from here. Oh, boy. Sandy and Madison, you're up next. Hi, Sandy.
Hello. My question is about a weed that I found in my perennial flower garden that's on a runner. The leaf is similar to a dandelion. And can grow quite tall if unattended. Any suggestions on getting rid of something like that?
Well, I would suggest, first of all, I'm not ringing a bell as the type of weed that you have there.
Okay.
Take a sample into the extension office, and they'll help you identify it. Usually with the perennials, what you can do is use something like Roundup and just spot treat the the plant, the rosetta leaves that you have, and then what it will do is kind of knock out systemically certain amounts of plants, but you have to kind of just only touch the plant that you want to kill, because if you hit your perennial flowers, they're gone too.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Just spot treat, and there's a few ways that you can do that. Some people will get the Roundup solution either in the spray bottle or whatever, but they'll dab it on a sponge and then just dab the weed that they want. In a flower bed, you can do that. If you have a large plot, then you have to try some other strategies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you so very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Andy, for calling. And Gretchen in Dousman, it's your turn now. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. I have a question about little oak trees that my squirrels seem to plant in my perennial garden. Am I able to dig up those acorns and little trees and transplant them?
Yes, you can. I would suggest doing it in September or so after you've had a pretty good frost.
Okay.
But usually when you have a little oak tree down there, the first year you have a rosette of leaves, it spends all of its energy developing a root system, and so you want to dig down about at least a foot below that plant and then try to move them.
Okay.
So you get enough root segment.
Okay.
It's going to be a little bit of a challenge.
Okay.
I usually tell people, people I want to grow nut trees, whether it's oaks or walnuts or hickory, plant the seed where you want the tree to be.
Yeah. Well, you just hate to waste all these great little trees that are going in the garden. So.
Understood.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Gretchen. And Dennis in Blanchardville, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Dennis.
There. I grow a considerable amount of pumpkins.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for some weed control. Is there any kind of herbicide that you could control the weeds without hurting the plants?
Yeah, there's an extension bulletin on growing cucurbits, and it has the weed control mechanisms in there, and we update that on an annual basis. If you're growing a lot of pumpkins, I would say go that route. If you only have a few that you grow, a couple suggestions would be, one, to start with transplants. Set out the transplants, but you can use a product like Preen or Treflan, and that impacts seed germination but does not impact the transplant that you're putting in. So there's a couple of options for you.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Dennis. Pat in Oshkosh, on to you. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. Two real quick questions. My first one, most importantly, is black spot on tomatoes. So back to tomatoes. Can you explain what it is and why it happens? How can I get rid of it?
The black spot is on the fruit or on the leaves?
On the fruit, right on the base. I've got some heirlooms, Howard German variety that just came up, and I clipped off a couple bundles of them already that as the fruit's coming up and just the base of it or the bottom of the fruit as it's hanging develops black rotten.
Blossom end rot. Yeah,
are you talking about on the end where the petals were?
It's right on the fruit, so I don't know what to tell you besides that.
Usually we've got problems there. One is on the stem end where it's attached to the plant, usually we have cracking. And the heirlooms are older varieties, and they tend to have more faults like that. On the other end, like Larry had mentioned, we'll start out with blossom end rot. And that usually is a result of improper or not having sufficient water to the plant at all times. And so during a hot day, the leaves are getting enough water, but that area isn't, so it's not carrying up enough calcium and other nutrients, and so those cells are in poor shape, and we have those deformities that occur on the end. Management by watering on a regular basis, even with tomatoes, a couple inches a week, but not all at one time. You want to apply maybe three-fourths of an inch, maybe every third day or something like that. That'll help alleviate some of those physiological problems. So it sounds like it's more physiological than disease.
Okay, and the other one then was I quit growing cucumbers because of powdery mildew. And I'll hang up if you want to explain that a little bit and what I can do maybe to avoid that.
Well, first thing I would do is look at the vegetable catalogs and look for disease-resistant varieties to powdery mildew. There are varieties out there that are resistant, and try to grow those. The other few other things to do when it comes to diseases: one, don't overpopulate your plantings, spread them out enough. I'll have them in full sun. If we have shade that overhangs the plant materials, you're just setting up a situation where the diseases can actually mature and start filling in. Usually the powdery mildews are later in the season. They attack older leaf tissue, and it's something that we have occur every year. But you should have at least about a 4 or 5 week period that you can have production with it before the diseases catch up to you. So disease-resistant varieties, full sun, are probably the two suggestions that I'd give you.
All right, Pat. Marissa in Hartford, on to you now. Hi, Marissa.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a 5-year-old magnolia tree, and the trunk divides into 3 main branches. And recently we've had heavy winds, and one of those branches has split from the main trunk. It's not actually detached, but there's quite a crack down the middle of the tree. And I'm just wondering if there's something I can do about that.
Well, one, you could contact an arborist, and they could try to salvage what's left there.
Okay.
The other option is it goes back. We often suggest proper training when you first start growing the plant so you don't have those branches coming out. You want wide-angled crotches when they do occur. At the fact that it's actually cracked now, usually we would suggest just simply cutting off that segment and trying to salvage the rest of the plant. Sometimes they will try bolting those together, but then that never really cures the problem. So I would suggest contacting an arborist and following their suggestions.
Okay. All right. I was afraid of that.
All right. Thanks, Marissa. Thanks for calling. And Matt at Stevens Point, we're on to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hello. I have a question on, I bought a Patmore green ash tree, and I'm just wondering, does that tree grow roots out, or does it keep the roots more in the ground? And if should that be planted in sandy soil or real good soil or whatever?
Okay. Usually the roots, all roots grow horizontally, and in fact about 60% or more of the roots are in the top 3 inches of soil. Usually they come to the surface because they have an entire environment, like you're watering your lawn or something, and so they're closer to the surface. Let's back up here. What I would suggest, and especially in your sandy soils up there, is if you plant the tree, try to keep the tree mulch with bark chips or something like that out to the drip line of the tree, and water it on a regular basis, and that'll tend to keep the roots in that zone and so they're not creeping out to the surface.
All right.
Okay, and then I have another question. I got some silver maple trees in the yard, and they're sending up little shoots, you know, 20, 30 feet away from the tree. Is there anything I can do to stop that from happening?
Mow them off.
Yeah.
Usually it could be seedlings that are coming up in those areas, and usually silver maples have a lot of seeds. Then they come in male and female. You must have a female plant, or your neighbor does. Yeah. But anyway, just mowing is about the only way to control that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Philip in Iola, your turn. Hi, Philip.
Yes, hello. A tomato wilt. Seem to get it every other year or something like that. And just besides resistant type plants, which doesn't seem to make much of a difference, is there something I'm doing wrong or something that in general can be done?
Usually with the wilts, the problem is that the disease organism will overwinter in the soil and survive for 3 to 5 years. My suggestion there is to dig up a new area and start your tomato plants there. The other thing that you need to do is when you go over to to till in a new area, remember when you tilled that diseased area, some of those diseases are stuck to the tines of your tiller, so you need to wash that off, maybe even use a Clorox solution or alcohol solution to really clean up the tines and try to move that around. We often suggest to, besides the disease resistance, to take plant materials and have a kind of a four-year rotation of some of your garden. The solanaceous plants, which would be peppers and tomatoes and eggplants, plant and then rotate them to another area. The same thing is true with your bean group and peas. That's another fairly good cluster of plant materials. A third cluster would be your cucurbits, which would be your melons and cucumbers and all your zucchini. Have that as a kind of a cropping area. And then it's all the catch-all rest, like your onions and your beets and corn and all that, which and this will that'll kind of keep some of your disease populations down.
All right. Good luck. Thank you, Phil. Louis in Waukesha, hello to you.
Hello. I have mature lilacs which stood in water for a good week and a half back when we were having our water problems. The shrivel of the leaves has now turned into brown and dry, and can I assume that they drowned?
Yep. Laura Jell, Dr. Laura Jell, just sent out a information on flooding of plant materials, and lilacs fell into the category of very sensitive.
Yeah.
In other words, they die. And so, yeah, they've been in the water too long. Usually we figure after 4 days, we start seeing plant loss. There are some plants like silver maple and some of those that can tolerate it. Last night when they were doing the FEMA report, of course, I'm always looking at the background. I'm not looking at who's ever doing the report. And you could see the plant materials. There were birch trees and other things started at the same stage that you're describing. The leaves were turning brown.
Yeah.
And so after the water subsides, you're going to have to replant and hope that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for calling. Andre in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Andre.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the show. It's great. I have a question. This morning, I was letting one of the dogs out, actually the bonehead of the group, and he took a flying leap after a squirrel into my butterfly bush.
Wow.
He broke the main stem or the main trunk, and the plant is really starting to come along nicely with some flower heads. I was wondering if, because it's the main stem, if I could tape it, if that might help the situation. It's still connected by part of the bark. Most of it is broken. What's your best guess?
You have multi-stems there?
Yes.
Okay. I would cut out that main stem.
Okay.
Because even if you tape it in the heels, it's, butterfly bushes are a situation where they're not really vigorous in this part of Wisconsin.
They aren't. And that's the main concern is that I finally got one to winter over.
Yep. And if you cut it off, they're still, it'll send up some new shoots to kind of replenish that area.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Peter in Bailey's Harbor next. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I have a question about transplanting plants in a rush of moving to our house and trying to do a lot in a short time. We just put a lot of different plants in one area. And now we are ready to do some transplanting. Most of them are bulbs. However, some of them are also some perennial, other perennial plants. What would be the best time during the year to actually maybe dig all of them up and put them in order and transplant
to put
them
where you want them, right?
Pardon? Yeah.
To place them in the landscape where you aesthetically want them. Just a couple of things. Usually your spring flowering plants is best to move those in the fall or through late summer. For example, the bulb plants like tulips and some of those, once the vegetative structure dries down, you could move those, and many times they're probably at that stage right now. Your fall or your plants that flower after the 1st of July, roughly, those are probably best transplanted early in the spring or very late in the fall. Those that flower in the spring, you know, before July 1st, I would transplant in the fall. So that kind of gives you, you know, using July 1st, if you blossom before that, you get moved in the fall. If you blossom after that, you probably get moved in the spring. Right. And usually your best transplanting periods are September or very early in the spring after the frost is out of the ground.
Okay. Is there anything
I should do with the bulbs, like clean them, dry them a little bit, or even dip them in some solution to eliminate some diseases. I hear things from people.
Yeah, there are, for example, with bulb crops, you can buy, there are some dips. You go down to any garden center, they'll have some bulb dip. And what that is a fungicide and sometimes an insecticide. So when you set that new plant out, you, even though you're very kind, you have little cuts and abrasions and things like that, and that'll help. Or you just leave them dry for a couple of days, and then, you know, I'm talking about bulbs at the top is died down.
Yeah.
Let the bulb dry for a couple of days. What it does is it develops a little callus tissue there, suberin materials and that types of things, and that'll give it some protection from some of the diseases, especially root rots.
All right.
And I heard before you were saying that it's good to transplant delphiniums every once in a while. Is this a bulb plant? Or
it's a tuberous root. It's a root structure that overwinters.
It's a root structure.
It's a perennial.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Peter. And Steve in Park Ridge, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I have a an old elm tree. It's in the northeast corner of my 50-foot lot on a residential street. It's probably 60, 70 feet tall, and, I don't know, 30 inches, 28 inches in diameter at the trunk. It seems like the branches are leaving or are disappearing. And over the last couple of years, we think the tree looks thinner and thinner. We're kind of concerned about it. We'd hate to lose this tree, and we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, in your situation, I suggest having an arborist come in. It sounds like Dutch elm disease that's slowly taking the tree. Some of the old rock elm.
Oh, I misspoke. This is a maple.
Yeah. Okay. Same thing. If it's declining, 30-inch trunk diameter, that's for some maples, it's getting to be the life of the tree. So it could be age. It could be we have verticillium wilt on maples that slowly works its way in. It takes several years to kill. But I would have an arborist come and take a look at it, and they give you a better synopsis of what's going on.
All right.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. Someone was wondering about broccoli. It's just about to produce at the center head. How do you get them to produce larger side shoots for harvesting later on?
Well, there are certain varieties that are prone to just a single head, and then like the Pac-Man, it'll send out some side shoots. Right now we're looking at, in fact, there's a graduate student that's working with the new dean at the agriculture that's looking at broccoli plants, and I spent a little time visiting with him last Friday. You know, hey, what are you doing here? And they're trying to select varieties that have more side shoots. And there are some varieties out there, and I think Diplomat is one of those that you can get through some of the seed companies that not only has a single shoot, but then the side shoots are 4 or 5 inches in diameter. So you end up with a fairly good production. In any case, if you want secondary production on broccoli in the home garden, we're looking at some type of shoot growth. Usually after you harvest the first center broccoli, fertilize the plants.
Oh,
and you can get some of those that are solution fertilizers, and what that'll do is stimulate some nutrients, and you'll have some better growth. Also, make sure that you water that 1 inch per week or so, and between water and nutrients, you'll end up with some larger side heads. Some varieties that we're looking at, we're hoping that'll produce, you know, once you have the first crop, produce side shoots all the way up until frost. And I've harvested broccoli, at least here in Wisconsin, all the way to the end of November, if the weather's right.
Bob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Yep. We'll be back.
You'll be back. Bob Tomesh, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison and with UW Extension. Thanks to him, and thank you very much for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.